When we set out in this series, we were trying to find out how Hitler's Third Reich was able to arm itself for World War despite the economic chaos that followed the Wall Street crash in 1929. Well, the answer turned out to be fascinating, complex. It involves catastrophic financial mismanagement by the American government, what was called at the time a mawkish dread of communism in the British government, and of course, the greed of businessmen, especially American manufacturers and British banks.
We could stop here, but the story goes on. It explains how Hitler's Third Reich was not only able to launch a war, but also how it kept it going. The scandals continued once war had broken out. Indeed, they grow much darker.
Just wait until you hear about IBM.
It's good to see you at the History Cafe. Thanks for joining us. This is where we come to give a new take on history. We revisit well-known stories that have got stuck in our collective memory, but just don't look right anymore. I'm Penelope Middlebow.
And I'm John Rosebank, and I suppose we have the best job in the world.
I think we do.
We take the latest research and we ask the questions that nobody else seems to, and we put it all into stories everyone can enjoy. So find yourself a coffee, pull up a chair, and let's see where we end up.
In 1939, just as in 1914, the Americans at first stayed out of the war. They regarded it as a golden opportunity to make money. The American Neutrality Act was supposed to prevent any American company from trading, quote, implements of war to any nation at war.
And it's important to understand that that means at war with anyone, not just at war with the USA.
But in November 1939, it was amended to allow the sale of arms under license. In practice, there were over 250 American-owned companies still operating in Germany, and they simply continued to trade with the Nazis. They built the trucks that invaded Poland, the Netherlands, Belgium and France, where they conveniently found the Ford maintenance infrastructure already in place. American companies were also fueling and equipping the bombers that blitzed London.
In 1940, Ford Germany was making 8,000 engines for the barges the Nazis were assembling, apparently to invade Britain.
Yeah, look at our series on the Battle of Britain.
Ford America simply defied the British Royal Navy blockade and sent materials and machine tools to Ford in Germany into 1941. Meanwhile, Ford in Bern, in neutral Switzerland, were repairing German military trucks, apparently on direct instructions from Ford in the US. And just a note here for anyone who's familiar with this material, yes, we're using some details from Charles Heim's controversial Trading with the Enemy. We don't buy Heim's interpretation, this was all some kind of Nazi American money plot, but more often than not, the details check out.
A detailed study by a team of historians published by Oxford in 2000 has shown, for all the predictable corporate denials, that from the summer of 1940, Ford Motor Company and General Motors in Germany used slave labour.
They were using slave labour.
They were mostly prisoners of war. These companies paid not the workers, but the German military authorities who supplied them. General Motors was also involved in Nazi campaigns to actually recruit civilian labour in France, Holland, Belgium, Slovakia and Italy, and forcibly transported to Germany to work in their factories. So at General Motors Russellheim Works, imported labourers worked alongside prisoners of war, who were also often Russian civilians deported and forced to work.
The management's instructions were that labour costs were, quote, to be kept as low as possible, and the working week sometimes stretched to 72 hours. This was the factory that made one in three of the trucks the German army used in the war. It was, in fact, making more money than it knew how to spend. Now, let's just add here that by contrast, historian Charles Cheap's study of the American company Norton's German subsidiary, DMG, found that it paid its foreign workers at the same rate as its German employees. DMG also tried to protect its Jewish distributor in Belgium. The implication is that what Ford and GM did, they did through choice.
Historian Mark Spoirer has in fact shown that Ford Motor Company and General Motors were never compelled by the Germans to accept slave labour. They voluntarily applied for it early in the war when they still retained some of their American management. General Motors wasn't even put under Nazi management until the end of November 1942. And the facts show that these companies kept their imprisoned workforce hungry and in terrible conditions in hastily constructed camps attached to their factories. The government made things worse. It laid down that slave labour should be stretched to the extreme.
By September 1944, there were 30,000 inmates in 250 camps run by Ford, who even employed several dozen skilled workers from the extermination camp at Buchenwald. Now, this is important. These Buchenwald metal workers were an exception. The excuse later given that companies employed slave labour in order to save men and women from the death camps is simply not true. These companies almost entirely used foreign men and women, prisoners of war and forced labour, up to 24 nationalities at any one time in the General Motors Brandenburg factory. By 1943, half the workforce at Ford Cologne was foreign, much higher than the average for German factories. Many, in fact, were Russian women. These were people who would not have been sent to the concentration camps. Ford was not saving them from death in the gas chambers.
The Czechoslovakian-German businessman Oskar Schindler did indeed build a camp in Krakow in Poland, where he employed 1,100 men and women and saved them from the gas chambers.
Yeah, ultimately, have you been there? Schindler's factory is still there in Krakow. You can go to his office there. Watch Schindler's List, which survivors say is as accurate a picture of Nazi occupation as they know.
But the difference between what Schindler was doing and what Ford and General Motors were doing is that he was employing Polish Jews who were being systematically exterminated. And that's completely different.
Now, the American companies have also always claimed that once America itself was at war with the Germans from December 1941, the Nazis put in their own management to run their subsidiaries and they lost all contact with them. Well, it's simply not true. Historians Reinhard Bilstein and Carola Fings found that wartime management was complicated, but that the official custodians put in by the authorities often had little say over what was going on. Proving that American companies were still in communication with their German factories is tricky, because as you would expect, many documents from the war have, they've gone missing.
But in fact, we know that it was not at all difficult to keep in touch. You just had to walk into Rick's bar in Casablanca.
Wonderful film.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Rick's bar in the film Casablanca, set in the North African town that was nominally under Vichy France rule, where Americans, Germans and French mix while Sam plays it again.
Sam, I thought I told you never to play.
American companies routinely stayed in contact with their German subsidiaries throughout the war. They deny it, of course, and many of the documents are now missing. But the truth is that we know that it wasn't at all difficult to meet your German managers or their representatives.
There were plenty of neutral places where meetings could be held. Portugal remained neutral, and smart Estoril, a short train ride from Lisbon, I remember going on holiday there, had for decades been a playground for the international rich and well-connected, doesn't include me. The Duke of Windsor, the abdicated Edward VIII, stayed at Cascais, just next door to Estoril, after quitting Paris when the Germans arrived, but staying, as we know, very much in touch with them. So if you wanted to keep tabs on your factory in Cologne or Rüsselsheim, all you had to do was to stroll on the beach in Estoril or visit the casino in Cascais, and there you could chat quite happily to your managers from your German factory with complete impunity.
Bankers from both sides of the conflict got together throughout the war for regular meetings of the Bank of International Settlements in Basel in neutral Switzerland, dining perhaps at the glitzy hotel Les Trois Rois.
Representatives of the American business family DuPont also were meeting the Germans in Switzerland, in Montreux and Samaritz. In the Swiss capital Bern, there was the absurd situation during the war in which the American embassy was being heated with German coal and its cars were running on German petrol. In fact, Esso had an office in the city.
The ITT chief, Sosthenes Bern, flew from New York via Madrid to Bern, Switzerland, during the war, to consult on the Nazi guidance systems that were being used to bomb London. In 1943, Ben met the boss of his German subsidiary for lunch at the royal suite of the Madrid Ritz. Among other things, they discussed Nazi radar. He also met officers from the German Signals Corps.
Of course, this was all the technology that would be used to shoot American planes down. Stockholm in neutral Sweden was, of course, another venue where, as we've seen in an earlier discussion, Enskilda Bank had contacts with a long roster of businesses in America and Germany. Across the Øresund in Denmark, historian Reinhold Bilstein found that General Motors probably continued communication with its German factories through its works in Copenhagen. He also found that Ford was keeping in contact with Germany through its factories in occupied France.
Charles Heim also charted in extraordinary detail how Germans and Americans use business networks throughout South America to pass on information and essential war materials. Under the Neutrality Act, American businesses were supposed to apply for licenses to trade with countries at war. And if they were found trading without a license, they were supposed to be investigated. So Heim came across vast piles of official documents about all of this.
Now, business historian Myra Wilkins, very distinguished historian, has shown that American businesses had enormously expanded into South America in the earlier part of the century, as well as into Asia, Oceania and Africa. In the summer of 1941, the American State Department investigated American firms refueling Italian and German vessels in Mexico. Once the war began, Esso was re-registering its tankers as Panamanian and shipping oil to Germany through Panama, Casablanca, Lisbon and Dakar, and then transporting it onto Madrid and Bern in Switzerland. American military intelligence also found Esso products passing through Aruba in the Dutch West Indies and then on to Tenerife and Tangier. Esso in Tenerife was refueling German U-boats.
Esso made little or no attempt to hide any of this. In fact, in 1940, it published its own map.
Yeah, it's on our website.
Yeah, proudly demonstrating how it was still connecting Forli Refinery on the British Solent, Hamburg on the German North Sea, and other installations in France, Italy and Romania. At the centre of the map are the words, big in Venezuela.
In Venezuela.
In huge type. The text boasts that Esso is producing 79 million barrels of oil in Venezuela. And then there are thick lines showing how it was shipping it across the Atlantic to the war zones of Europe. To one side is a flag boasting that Esso had also increased its Panamanian registered shipping to 579,000 tons. Hooray!
Chase Bank of Manhattan, meanwhile, was finding ways to send cash through Brazil, Chile or Uruguay to its Paris branch, which remained open throughout the German occupation. ITT was operating its telephone systems through South America so that documents, charts and patent information, for example, could easily be sent to Germany. What's astonishing is that the American government was aware of much of this and allowed it to continue. In the loft of one of its lawyers, Charles Heim came across papers from a 1945 US Treasury investigation of Ford's wartime operation. They included letters sent after America and Germany were at war by Edsel Ford, who was Henry Ford's son. He was writing to factories in Germany. Among other things, they detailed improvements that were being made to trucks being manufactured for the German army.
You couldn't make it up. In fact, in 1942, after America was at war with Germany, Breckinridge Long, the US Assistant Secretary of State, agreed that Edsel Ford could continue to send his letters to Germany through neutral Lisbon using a Portuguese carrier. Letters to Ford France, which was now making vehicles for the German army, were even being passed through the American embassy in Vichy, France. And the Ford factory at Poissy, just outside Paris in occupied France, was obviously still in contact with Ford in Germany.
And so we contact Ford Germany through the embassy in Vichy, France, and then Ford Poissy. In fact, it took about 2 weeks for a letter from Paris to reach Ford HQ at Dearborn in the States. Breckinridge Long forwarded at least one letter from Paris to Dearborn himself. If you've been with us in earlier discussions, you won't be surprised that it was mainly Henry Morgenthau at the Treasury Department in Washington who launched investigations into American businesses that continued through the war to trade with companies known to be in touch with Nazi Germany. Charles Haim came across the records of dozens of investigations beginning in 1940 and continuing throughout the war and indeed immediately afterwards. Morgenthau seized at least 50 companies. He also launched a series of attempts to close down the sprawling tentacles in the states connected to the German chemicals conglomerate IG Farben. When Morgenthau showed President Roosevelt the evidence of American companies continuing to cable their subsidiaries in occupied France, he wrote in his diary that the president called it, quote, amazing and shocking.
Over at the FBI, Edgar Hoover was similarly on the trail of a whole series of networks linking American companies and the trade with Nazi Germany. Future President Harry Truman conducted a series of hearings into Esso in March 1942 and ended up accusing it of treason.
Treason, American company.
In May 1944, a judge declared Esso, quote, an enemy national. The campaigning liberal journalist Izzy Stone, meanwhile, pursued evidence of continuing American links to IG Farben, the chemical manufacturer, and Esso's continuing trade to Germany.
I was lucky enough to meet Izzy Stone in London shortly before his death in 1989. Great man. But it turned out to be very difficult to stop any of this scarcely concealed trade between prominent American companies and Germany. Charles Haim, of course, alleges that it was all a high-level conspiracy. But something much more chilling than that was going on.
All the evidence suggests that American companies continued to supply Nazi Germany through the war and to be in touch with their German subsidiaries. And the US government knew all about it. Now, one diamond dealer, Leonard Schmidt, was found guilty of trading through Panama, fined over $100,000 and went to prison for 5 years. But Schmidt was an exception. And a small person, I suppose, you know. Yes. As we saw before when we were discussing the 1930s, it was primarily the State Department with Cordell Hull, though there were others, that stepped in all the time to protect American business interests.
Now, Charles Haim implies that there was either corruption or political collusion among individuals in state, justice and various other government departments, especially those involved in military procurement. And as he points out, many of the men employed in those departments were still active in the businesses they were supposed to be regulating. The Economic Welfare Council, for example, included several executives from Esso.
But there are more likely explanations than a conspiracy. As we saw, Secretary of State Cordell Hull had spent years trying to repair American relations with Latin America, and he may have just decided that protecting his good neighbour policy was more important than tackling every single breach of the Trading with the Enemy Act through South American countries.
But above all, it looks clear that there were a number of companies, ITT, Ford, General Motors, Esso and Chase among them, that were simply too important to the American war effort to be challenged.
Now we're getting to it.
The Americans knew perfectly well that Esso, for example, was supplying the Germans from oil fields in Romania and Hungary. But the American embassy in the Swiss capital Bern pointed out to Washington that, well, they themselves were dependent on oil coming from Germany. Although they knew perfectly well that Esso was leasing barges to the Germans and supplying oil to the weapons manufacturers Krupps and the chemical firm IG Farben, the American embassy in the Swiss capital Bern recommended doing nothing.
So Washington consulted London, and both agreed that Esso was just too important to their own war effort to be interfered with. The State Department went on licensing Esso shipments to Latin American companies with known links to the Nazis throughout the war. And this is extraordinary. The British Navy, presented with these American licenses, had no option but to let the Esso tankers through their blockade.
So let's just be clear. Companies like Esso, Ford, General Motors, ITT, among many others, chose to make money out of both sides of the conflict, trading with America's enemies and prolonging the agony for goodness knows how long. And they got away with it because they were simply too big to be stopped. But the moral's perfectly plain. Never trust businessmen with moral decisions.
Now, SKF is a perfect example. Although it wasn't an American company, it was Swedish.
But it's an example about which we have information because the documents somehow survived.
SKF in Sweden made ball bearings, which is more technically difficult than it sounds.
And much more important too. I don't think you could make a machine in the 1940s without ball bearings.
The American military complained that they were short of ball bearings. This was very serious. And they discovered that the key factory in Philadelphia, which was a subsidiary of the Swedish company SKF and also connected with the German company Bosch, was exporting its bearings through South America to Germany.
So the Philadelphia company was exporting its ball bearings to Germany and leaving the American military short of ball bearings. SKF's main manufacturer was based in Sweden, and it was well known that it was supplying ball bearings to both the Germans and to the British, and indeed to the Americans too. Well, no surprise, they were neutral, the Swedes. Historian Eric Golson estimated that SKF were making, now hear this, 58% of all the ball bearings in Germany during the war, and 31% of all the ball bearings in Britain. In which case, it doesn't work this out, they could almost single-handedly have stopped the war in its tracks had they stopped making ball bearings. But they chose not to. They chose to go on making money.
In April 1944, Henry Morgenthau at the US Treasury finally got permission to send his man to Stockholm to do something about it. On the way, he picked up a representative of the British Red Cross in London. And together, they sat down in the boardroom of Enskilda Bank to negotiate.
Enskilda Bank, we've heard plenty about that bank before.
SKF, sitting in the room, denied supplying any ball bearings to the Germans. So the Red Cross man took out a packet of ball bearings and asked the SKF representatives where they'd been made.
Yeah, he said, yeah, good ball bearings, yeah, made in Stockholm.
Well, said the Red Cross man, every one of these was taken from a German plane shot down over London.
Well, after weeks of negotiation, the Americans agreed to pay $8 million to SKF through Enskilda to stop supplying Germany with ball bearings.
To stop supplying it.
And the Americans offered immunity from prosecution after the war. Enskilda Bank took the money from the Americans. But Washington was quickly able to establish SKF continued to supply the Germans through Spain, Portugal and Switzerland. And when the ball bearings they sent were not enough, they sold steel and ball bearing making machines to Germany to make more. Well, no surprise, the Swedes were making much more money from the Germans than they were from Britain and America. SKF ball bearings went on being shipped even from Philadelphia via South America, eventually to Germany throughout the war.
Poor old Henry Morgenthau at the Treasury found he couldn't do anything about it. The State Department even instructed him to put out statements praising SKF's contribution to the war effort.
And so we come to what may be the darkest case of them all, IBM.
Edwin Black tells the story of Edya, a 12-year-old Jewish girl who was among the people locked in a freight truck on a train bound for the extermination camp at Treblinka. The men in the truck managed to force open the ceiling ventilator and pushed Edya, the only one small enough, out and onto the roof. With the train still rattling along, they lowered her down, hanging onto a towel, until, with her mother shouting over her screams to run and go tell someone what the Nazis were doing, they let go.
Edya survived the fall, hid in a forest, met a German boy, Herschel, and spent the rest of the war with him, fighting with the resistance. The rest of Edya's family were killed. Edya and Herschel later married and emigrated to the States, and they were Edwin Black's parents.
Now, Edya's son, Edwin Black, had written a number of understandably angry, popular books and articles detailing IBM's role during the war in Germany and its occupied territories. What's beyond doubt is that IBM business machines, punch card statistical tabulators originally developed for crunching American census data, were absolutely essential, not only for the German rearmament programme and wartime procurement, but also for organising the Holocaust.
It was an enormous statistical challenge to round up millions of Jewish people like Edia and her family, to transport them by rail across Europe, sort them into those who would work and those who would immediately be gassed, and then keep track of those who still lived and those who had died. At every stage, it was only possible because of IBM machines. Now, we all know that each inmate of the concentration and death camps was identified by a five-figure number tattooed infamously on their arm. What very few of us realised was that those numbers began as IBM punch card numbers.
Edwin Black asserts that IBM America, under its domineering boss Thomas Watson, remained in contact with its German operation throughout the war. Well, it's certainly possible because, as we've seen, there were dozens of ways to keep in touch. And what makes it more likely in IBM's case is that it never sold its machines to anyone in the world. It only ever leased them and then oversaw their use and maintenance.
Now, like other American companies, IBM had taken over an existing German business, Dänemark. However, unlike, for example, Ford or General Motors, IBM never established an easy working relationship with its subsidiary Dänemark, whose founder, Willy Heidinger, continued to be in charge and to develop his own machines. Heidinger was openly pro-Nazi. He was equally openly hostile to Thomas Watson, the IBM boss.
Like other companies, Dänemark was put under official German guardianship during the war. But so crucial was the IBM punch card system that the German military set up their own process, which was then in turn taken over directly by the Berlin government. Historian Lars Haider has therefore concluded that under this unusually direct governmental control, Dänemark was, quotes, virtually independent of IBM in America for the duration of the war.
On the other hand, however, an American legal case in 2001 argued that IBM stayed very much in touch with Dänemark throughout the war and had, as other companies, prevented historians from using its archive to find out. Now, that legal case was discontinued not for want of evidence, but because IBM agreed to pay into a compensation scheme on condition that all cases were dropped. Well, you can read the evidence for yourself and make up your own mind. If it is true, as Black has always claimed, that IBM of America knowingly provided the machines that enabled the Holocaust to happen, then words are lacking to express the disgust we all feel.
This story began in the First World War. During that war, the United States broke with long international custom and refused to share its resources with those alongside whom it was fighting. By the end of the First World War, Britain and France were so deeply indebted to the Americans that their economies had little chance of reconstruction. But the Americans refused to concede a cent, until, that is, they were at last forced to, when Europe's indebtedness, along with the gross inequalities of the Americans' own economy, dragged the world into financial crash and depression in 1929. It was out of those ruins that the Third Reich appeared.
Utterly incredibly, the Americans took exactly the same path in World War II, complaining bitterly that they had still not yet been repaid their loans from the First World War. They refused to share their resources again in the Second World War. In an almost exact repeat of 25 years before, the Americans stood back, stayed out, and tried to make money from both sides. Once again, within 2 years, the British were virtually out of credit. Once again, it was the US government that bailed them out. Once again, not by sharing anything, but once again, through loans, this time under what was called the Lend-Lease Programme.
Economists' figures vary.
Well, of course they do.
But let's take historian Adam Tooze's view. He reckons that by the end of the conflict, the British had borrowed $5.4 billion from the USA. It was the prelude to an international conference in 1944 at Bretton Woods in New England. And there, in another exact replay of the previous war, the British economist Maynard Keynes was again sidelined by the Americans. This time, he was subjected to sustained attack by Morgenthau's chief economist, Harry Dexter White.
Now, White's system railroaded through a conference in which the Americans exercised all the enormous additional financial muscle they'd accumulated in the course of another war, apparently established the American dollar once and for all as the world's key currency, the so-called reserve currency, against which everything else would be measured.
The whole thing would probably have ended once again in financial crash and ruin. But in 1948, the Americans suddenly stepped in and put up over $13 billion in grants made available in cash or in trade credits to European countries, and especially to Britain and France. Well, it's what they should have done in 1921.
Of course, there were strings attached, privileges for American companies that would lead to what is being called the Coca-Colonization of the world, the takeover by American companies. But it saved Europe from a repeat of the misery of the 1920s and 1930s. This time, reconstruction was possible.
So why, this time, did the Americans launch an enormous program of relief, what became known as Marshall Aid, named after Secretary of State General George Marshall? It was often justified by quoting from a speech President Truman had given to joint houses of Congress on the 12th of March 1947. He said, quote, "The seeds of totalitarian regimes are nurtured by misery and want. They spread and grow in the evil soil of poverty and strife."
And that's the key to it. Of course, Truman's target was the threat of communism. In the last year of the war, Stalin had taken over Eastern Europe, including the east of Germany. The Americans had, at whatever cost to the US Treasury, to prevent economic collapse in West Germany, France, Italy, or anywhere else. The reason was that misery and want would surely lead, as the Americans had seen it lead in the mid-1930s, for example, in France and Spain, to dangerous leftist regimes. And they, in turn, might look to the Soviets for support. So nothing had changed. This was still the playbook of the 1930s. Only this time it was the Americans and not the British who were most afraid of the communists. And the Americans had money to throw around.
And this changed everything. Throughout the war, Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau had spearheaded investigations into American companies that were trading with the Nazis. In 1945, American military investigators pored over documents seized in occupied Germany and interrogated thousands of those, German and American, who had abetted the Nazi regime. Morgenthau even proposed that Germany should lose all its heavy industry and never be allowed to rebuild. Truman summarily fired him, saying Morgenthau didn't know shit from apple butter.
The point was that for Truman, West Germany had to be turned into a modern industrialized barrier against the Soviets. Morgenthau left politics and devoted himself to Jewish causes. He was, of course, Jewish himself. There was never any serious question of bringing the Nazis to justice or those who had colluded with them. Just 21 leading Nazis were put on trial at Nuremberg. They included Hjalmar Schacht, the former president of the Reichsbank and Hitler's Minister for Economics. Among much else, as we've seen in this series, Schacht had worked not only with the American companies, but also with the governor of the Bank of England. Together, they had kept British finance pouring into Nazi Germany. 10 of the accused were eventually hanged.
The judges couldn't agree on Schacht's case, and so he was acquitted. His memoirs, published in Germany under the title 76 Years of My Life,
but in America as Confessions of the Old Wizard,
begin with the day in September 1948 when he walked free from the internment camp at Ludwigsburg. It was 25 degrees, but he was wearing a fur coat. He claims it was because underneath his clothes were in rags. His memoirs make it perfectly clear that he regarded his trial as a farce.
Everyone else, the salarymen and the managers of car manufacturers and oil companies and chemical plants, communications specialists, and the makers and maintainers of business machines, were left to go back to their businesses, a veil drawn over the shocking facts of the previous decade. The American companies and the British banks and everyone else who had enabled Nazism and made possible its war of conquest were allowed simply to slip away, taking their stories with them.
The New York lawyer Foster Dulles, who'd been at the very heart of American business deals with Germany in the 1920s and 30s, became US Secretary of State in 1953 and a loud leading voice in the Cold War against communism. the fight against the Soviets trumped every moral consideration.
And that was why nobody was ever going to be called to account for trading with the Nazi enemy. There are nearly 100 podcasts at the History Cafe, all of them still as new as the day they were recorded. Go to our website, historycafe.org, and you can get a rundown on the research we've done and plenty of leads to follow if you still want more.
You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every other platform you can think of. Just look out for History Cafe Podcast with John and Penelope. If it's your thing, follow us on Instagram and what used to be Twitter at History Cafe Pod, and ask your friends to join us too. We'll